we're going to be looking at this morning, I would suggest, is one of the densest theological passages probably in the whole Bible. So, we seem to be a little echo here, or is it just me? Maybe it's just me, okay? That's fine if it's just me. So we're looking at 1 Colossians, just 1 Colossians? There is only 1 Colossians. So we look at Colossians 1, 15 to 20. What I'd like to do this morning is to do something which I don't think I've ever done before preaching, actually, which is to go through literally a bit at a time through the whole passage and really look at what this passage is going to be saying to us. I'm going to read it. We're going to think a little about the context in which this is written again, just as a reminder. And then we're going to be spending some time just going through 8 chunks of these passages, these verses, to really dig into what is it that Paul is trying to say in this passion to the believers in Colossae. So let's read it. I'll read it from the NIV, although I think actually there's a few flaws in the NIV translation, but let's not worry too much about that for the moment. So let's read. So I hope you've got your Bibles open in front of you. We are going to be looking at the verses up on the screen together as we go through, but it's always good, I think, to have your finger in the Bible so you're actually looking at it as we go through. So in my Bible, this one comes under the heading, The Supremacy of Christ, which is not a great description. I prefer the preeminence of Christ. That sounds far grander to my mind, which is what if you've got a New King James, that's what the New King James would be heading it. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For by him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things were created by him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He's the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. It's a pretty awesome passage, isn't it? I mean, just without digging into it, we could just kind of reflect on that for the next half an hour, and probably we'd get an awful lot more out of it than I'm going to tell you the next half hour or so. Though hopefully I'll add one or two things. But this passage is, some people think it was actually like a hymn that Paul was quoting or writing and giving to them. If I was bolder, I'd perhaps try and sing that passage, but I'm not sure kind of how I'd rhythmically do it. But it's that sense of it's worship. This is about worshiping who Jesus really is and revealing to the church in Colossae, this is who Jesus really is, in case you had any questions around it. So as a reminder, before we start to wander through the passage, obviously Paul was in Ephesus. We think he was there for around 3 years, and Epaphras, one of his buddies, went out from there to Colossae. And that's how Paul has this link where he clearly views it under his apostolic covering. And as a reminder, the reason he's writing this letter is that it's become clear that there are issues which he doesn't explicitly refer to what all the issues were, what all the heresies, as we might call them, were. But we can pick up a fair sense of it through piecing together various bits throughout the rest of the book, which we've referred to in the past. So I'm just going to quickly mention them in passing, just so we have in mind. There's a sense of there's some sort of mystical experiences which the church is engaging in or feeling is necessary as a part of their faith. There's a sense of there are rituals which are humiliating, he refers to in chapter 2. So not exactly sure what they're doing, but there's a, they're lowering themselves in order to, in their mind, connect to God. There's a sense of something else other than Jesus being required to access God, whether it's angelic worship or the idea of There was a particular heresy at this time early in the church of there were levels of Godhead, and you had to kind of go through levels before you acted. You actually approached the ultimate power. And so maybe there's that sense of the particular practices that were being taught in Colossae. And all of this that led to them having a kind of arrogance or a superiority in their faith as they're following their own rituals, their own way of doing things. He refers to them being puffed up. So there's pride thrown into the mix as well. And at a headline level, into this context, Paul, firstly, and this is broadly speaking, the first two chapters of the book, corrects the view that they have of Christ. And then secondly, the last half of the book corrects their actions and their behaviour. And if we were to kind of split that down a little bit more granularly, you could say that he starts out by really asserting the care that he and Epaphras, and perhaps Timothy as well, is also a co-author of this letter, that they have for them. He spends a big chunk on that passage that was being read about, talked about last week, of being committed in prayer for them, is showing just how much care and love they, as those who have oversight for them, have. Then he moves into the passage correcting their view on Jesus, and then reveals, because of who Jesus is, who they are in him, and what the consequences of knowing who Jesus really is as regards what they shouldn't be doing. And then flowing from that, what the right consequences are of what they should be doing. So there's a correction of their thinking that goes on throughout this letter, born out of love for the people, starting out looking at who is Jesus, therefore you shouldn't be doing some of the things you're doing, and therefore this is what you should be doing in the way you think and the way you carry out your life. And it's interesting that the principal focus of Paul throughout this letter is on Jesus, as if the answer to all their problems in how they are carrying out their church life is to look at the character of Jesus. It's interesting because you could answer that in different directions, potentially. You could have said they need to be focusing more on how the Spirit is moving in their church. But actually, it's not. He basically doesn't talk about the Spirit at all. There's only one verse which references the Spirit, and it is right near the beginning in 1 verse 8, when he refers to the fact that these are believers who express love in the Spirit. So there's a sense in which he's not overly worried about their understanding of the Holy Spirit, because they clearly are expressing love in the Spirit to each other. But it's their understanding of who Jesus is which is in need of correction. And I guess there's a question that was worth posing right at the start of this, which is, do we ever worry about whether we're doing the right things in church? Or do we ever look at other churches or other Christians and think, are they doing something utterly weird? And if we do, then there's a pretty simple answer. Look at Jesus. And if what we're doing is expressing what we understand of Jesus, then we're probably okay. And we could probably put that exact same test to other branches of the church as well. But anyway, that's by way of introduction. Now let's get on to the meaty part. So, let's... Oh, come on. Ah, it is up there, but it's kind of... let me shrink that temporarily so we can see. The first bit, that the Son is the image of the invisible God. In other words, if you want to see what the invisible God looks like, then you need to look at Jesus. It's quite a bizarre phrase in some respects, isn't it? Because the very definition of something which is invisible is you cannot see it. So surely the revelation of seeing something which is invisible is something which is invisible. But no, this is the whole extraordinary thing about Jesus, is that he makes the invisible God visible. Indeed, he says that very clearly of himself in John 14:9. Anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. So what Paul is repeating is nothing other than what Jesus already said about himself. If you want to know what the Father looks like, then all you have to do is look at Jesus. They are one and the same. And one of the things which has really struck me as I've been thinking about today is just thinking again about Jesus' position in the Trinity. And that's why I asked Rebecca deliberately to do a few songs which were talking about the fullness of the Godhead. And I've also been reading a book, which I thought I was going to waft around. It's here, which is an excellent book if you haven't read it, which is Roger Forster's book on the Trinity. Extremely deep, thinking about just who is Jesus, who is the Father, who is the Holy Spirit, and how does their relationship affect our understanding of God? It's extremely deep. It's only about 120 pages long, so it's actually
quite accessible,
but deep at the same time. And some of it's quite controversial in terms of how you would think of things. And some of the analogies used to understand God, the ways of describing God, aren't ways which I would naturally have thought of, so quite thought-provoking. But anyway, I consider going off on a big tangent down that path, but I'll go off on a little tangent, if I may. Otherwise, I won't get through my 8 points. But it got me thinking, I wonder how often we reflect on Jesus' position in the Trinity. We're so used to talking about Jesus as the revelation, and we think about it at this time of year, as we're thinking about Christmas, and we sing things without perhaps even thinking about the words, very God, begotten, not created, all those kind of things. And we're so used to it that I wonder actually how deeply we think about who Jesus really is in the context of the Godhead. Let me put that a different way, if I may. If we didn't have the revelation of who God is through Jesus, what would our understanding of God be? It's quite interesting, isn't it? Think of it the other way around. Because actually, if we think of it on those terms, we've talked a lot about Muslims this morning, it'll help us understand the Muslim faith a lot more. Because a God who is singular, alone, not manifest as flesh on earth, that we can actually see, touch, feel what he looks like, is a very different expression of God. I just had 3 points I wanted to mention in passing, just as something which you might want to reflect on. First thing is, God would stand alone. If we don't have the revelation of God through Jesus, then God is distant. He stands alone. One of the things Roger Forster says, actually not in this book, but on a talk I listened to, he said, if God has nothing to relate to, he has nothing to say that he is there. He doesn't even know that he exists. A sole Muslim or a Jehovah's Witness deity stands in complete and total isolation. Before the world began, he doesn't even know that he is there because he has nothing to relate to. Quite deep. But in the Trinity, we have a Godhead that is relational. In other words, before we were created, God was already relating within himself. The Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit have existed for all time, relating to each other. It's not that Jesus suddenly appeared, as the Jehovah's Witnesses would believe. He wasn't created. We're going to come to that in a moment. He existed for all time. Therefore, it is out of a relationship of God. And we're going to pick into a little bit of what that relationship looks like. It's out of that relationship that we are created. Second thing is, a God which stands alone, similar point, couldn't relate to us. So a monotheistic, purely monotheistic deity is separated from creation and has no means to relate to creation other than from a distance. But our God is a relational God that reaches into our existence through his incarnation. And the third point is that God, as a singular God, not revealed to us in bodily form, is actually, this is a bit tricky to understand, an unchanging and an unmoving God. And this actually affects a lot of our modern thinking today in subtle ways which we perhaps don't even recognize. The ancient Greeks, they thought of God as somebody who was immovable, because to their understanding, to be perfect as God must be, you couldn't change. So therefore you have these kind of the marble images of God being expressed without emotion, without expression, because if you're expressing emotion, then you're changing. You're moving from one state to another state. Whereas their understanding was God couldn't express emotion, because if he did, then he's changing. And God is immovable because God is perfect. So you had Aristotle, for example, call God the unmoved mover, the movement being created, but unmoved because that was it. That was all he did. It's like creation and then step back from creation to see what played out. And in very subtle ways, that has affected a lot of modern theology. The idea that God is distant, but actually the whole point, the whole Hebrew understanding of God is a God who is deeply involved with his creation on an ongoing basis, a God who is extremely emotionally involved with his creation, a God who gets angry, a God who gets sad, a God who expresses joy and laughter and dance. And yet sometimes, even in subtle ways, even if we look at art sometimes, the way that God is expressed, he is distant, unmoved, unconcerned, perhaps, with his creation. Because a lot of our modern thinking, a lot of secular modern thinking, is born out of that ancient Greek view which comes through in the Enlightenment period. And it's not enlightening at all, actually. But in contrast, that a relational three-in-one God is capable of emotion. We see that expressed not only in the Old Testament in how God comes across, but very much in Jesus, where we see him getting angry when he goes, think of that, one of my favourite passages in the temple, clearing the temple, gets angry. He expresses love, expresses joy, he expresses sorrow. So there's just a couple of points that I'm nudging towards, and I apologise, I'm spending more time on this one than I'm going to spend on the others as I'm looking slightly at the clock. First point I'm trying to get to is that the very nature and existence of the Trinity reveals an extraordinary amount to us about who God is. That God is relational, he is connected. He is over us, he is alongside us, he is in us. Father, Son, Spirit. Secondly, that because Jesus is the image of God, if we want to know what God is like, then we look at him. And who is he? We've done that perhaps a couple of years ago when we had the series looking quite a lot at Jesus, the Beautiful Outlaw series we looked at. He is passionate. He is emotional. He is loving. He is kind. He's humble. It's interesting, I've been struck again about the humility that exists within the Trinity. John 5:19, we have Jesus saying that he can do nothing unless he sees the Father do it. And in a few verses' time in this passage, we see the Father expressing delight that the fullness of the Godhead is expressed in the Son. This idea is it's not about hierarchy, and we can sometimes get distracted of is God, is the Father number one, and the Son is underneath, and the Spirit underneath. It's not about hierarchy at all. It's about servanthood, even within the Godhead. Extraordinary. So it's about not pushing self forward, even within the Godhead. And so how do we reflect that in terms of how we live our lives and how we live our amongst ourselves as the body of the church? So the message to the church in Colossae, even from this very first little sentence, if they really unpicked it, was actually quite clear. Look at who Jesus is. Look at who you know that he was. They're not so many years removed from Jesus being physically present. They got people who knew Jesus that they can talk to about what was he like. And that reveals all you need to know about how you should be living out your faith. Was Jesus puffed up? Proud? No. He was simplistic in many respects in how he lived his faith. That's one. Seven to go. The firstborn overall creation. This is one of those verses which has been misunderstood with devastating effect in some branches of not only the church potentially, but certainly outside. The Jehovah's Witnesses, for example, would latch onto this verse to say, Jesus was created. He was the first of creation. That is completely wrong. This is actually about emphasizing completely the opposite. This is emphasizing that he is in priority to the whole of creation, that he pre-exists creation. In other words, he is eternal. And when we think of firstborn, it's not talking so much about chronology as it's talking about position. So his position is sovereign, preeminent. He is in management, if you like. Control, authority. If you think about it, and flip back to Old Testament stories, talking about firstborn rights, all those kind of things, you can see that even in the Old Testament, we don't always see that the firstborn is the one that gets the rights of the firstborn. Think of Isaac and Esau. You could even think of David, potentially. He's the youngest of all the sons, yet he is the one that is chosen by God to be the king. So firstborn is about position, about authority, and not just about chronology. So as I said earlier, it's very apt in the run-up to Christmas to remind ourselves that Jesus didn't come into being at that moment. Sometimes we can have that mindset, and certainly most people would have that mindset out there, that Jesus was just born, and his little baby, and he grew up, and oh, then it became apparent he was God. No, he always has been. It's not that he was the firstborn just as of the baby. He is eternal. And his coming to earth in the incarnation was stretching out of the Godhead into our humanity. That's the extraordinary thing, which sometimes people just miss. I told you I'd get quicker. Number three. For in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. I don't know if you noticed when we were reading this whole passage just how often it says the words all things. I think it's actually referred to four, maybe even five times. It talks about all things. Now, the Greek words used for that are equivalent to saying the universe. So when we're saying this, we could actually read this as, for in him, the universe was created, things in heaven and earth, visible and invisible, blah, 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 blah. This one in a bit more detail. So he is the creator of the things in the heavenly realms. He is the creator of things on earth. He is the creator of the things which are seen and are unseen. He is the creator of the powers and authority structures. That's pretty much a definitive list, to my way of thinking. The things you can see, the things you can't see, even the very power structures that we've got on earth, he created them. Isn't that pretty mind-blowing? That Jesus, that this humble man that we think about and we see all those cheesy representations and telly things of this man walking around in a white robe, he is the one who created all you see in the heavenly realms, on earth, everything. And it echoes that passage which we read earlier from John. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. So again, Paul is only saying what others have been saying. But when you put it all together in this package in the way that Paul's doing here, it's just mind-blowing. And here, Paul actually then goes a step further. For not only is everything created through him, but everything is created for him. I confess, I don't understand all of that. Because it's so mind-blowing. Just to even think about, which is why, if I'm honest, the only way we can reflect on this passage really is worship. Because it's just a wow kind of thing of, God, I don't understand all of this, but it's amazing. Again, it's what Jesus said about himself in Revelation. I am the Alpha and the Omega. I am the first and the last. In other words, I started all creation and it's all coming back to me. He's the boomerang God. He starts the creation. Not like that Greek view of God of stepping back and seeing what happens, but it's all, he's involved in it, sees what happens, and it's all for his glory at the end of the day, not just to puff himself up, no, because he wants others to share in the amazing joy of relationship and creation as well. Extraordinary, isn't it? So this is the picture that Paul's building. We have Jesus is God. Jesus is this God that creates everything that's done. He instigates everything. It's done for him. He's involved in everything. It returns to him. It gets more. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. So hang on. So we've got this God. He created everything. It's all for him. And actually, everything that we can see that he's created holds together because of him.
In other words, the universe, as we know it today, and science enables us to know the universe in a lot more detail than they did when Paul was writing this, the universe is held together at a matter and atom level because of Jesus. If there was no Jesus, the universe would be obliterated. Isn't that extraordinary? But that's literally what it is saying. That literally, if no Jesus, everything, we wouldn't be here. Everything would just disappear. The very particles that exist, physical matter, would cease to exist. Because Jesus is the one that holds it all together. He is the God particle. And that's why when you look at science and you see these patterns in science, which are hard for people to explain, and that certain numbers that crop up again throughout science, certain forms and patterns and structures, it shouldn't be a surprise to us. Because there's the common thread through everything which holds together is Jesus. The very matter and stuff that we look at reveals Jesus. That chair reveals Jesus. Did you know that? Extraordinary, isn't it? So let's just pause again, just for a second. This is the picture that Paul's building. Jesus shows us the revelation of God. Jesus is the source of all creation. Jesus is the source of all power and authority. Whether we even think we recognize that or not, he is. Jesus is the creator of all. The creation is for him, and he is the one that holds all of creation together. Huh. Wow. And then he throws in this one. I love this. And he's the head of the body, the church. Isn't that just a bizarre contrast? When you think about it, I mean, we can just read it and it trips off the tongue. But actually, given all that I've just been talking about this extraordinary creator, powerful, wow, God, and he's the head of the church, like, that feels a bit nothing after all that, doesn't it? That's right. So Paul flips on that extraordinary revelation and then throws this in. And this isn't, of course, an isolated picture of Jesus as the head of the church. We can think of 1 Corinthians 12 or Romans 12. But interesting, the contrast is in those passages, actually what Paul is talking about is how does the body outwork itself through giftings, anointings, callings, offices, if you want to call it that. But here, it's not talking about that at all. This is talking about reinforcing the status of who Jesus is. His way of engaging in creation. And so the clear message that Paul is giving is that in the context of who Jesus is in creation, that he purposed that he should have a body. Not just for those 33 years when he was on earth, but he should have a body throughout time, present on earth. And his body is us. And he purposed that before creation. That we're going to come on to the next verse. In fact, I'll throw it up. Ready? Yeah. I agree. Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. But it appears it in a way, doesn't it? Yes, I agree. So he goes on. He expands on the passage, and again, this is a continuation. You'll notice it's not a separate point. He flips into when he says this. He is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. So he flips back to the idea of the firstborn again, and so you might think he's raising the same point, but actually it's slightly different this time. This time what he's talking about is in the context of his relationship with the church. So it's not talking about a firstborn of creation in that sense. He's talking about, he is the two things. First, he is the beginning, literally paralleling as the originator of creation and paralleling that as the word making creation and him originating the church. Secondly, he's speaking as firstborn, literally, chronologically this time, as he is the firstborn in the founding of the church, because he is the firstborn from the dead under the power of his resurrection. So we have this contrast of firstborn in creation, eternal, and firstborn chronological in the founding of the church. And the point Paul is making is this amazing God, of eternal God out there, here with us, in us, that created everything you can see, in everything you can see, is also the one who founded the church. And because of that, he is supreme over everything, so you cannot question him at all. So his supremacy is absolute, not only in creation, but also in the church. This is the passage I mentioned in the context of the humility of amongst the Godhead. God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him. The Father is delighted that there is absolute fullness expressed through Jesus. In other words, there is nothing missing. It expresses the same thing again in the passage in chapter 2, verse 9. It says pretty much the same thing. For in Christ, all the fullness of the deity lives in bodily form. You could argue he's overemphasizing this when he says all the fullness. Well, if it's fullness, it's already full. Why does he need to say all? He's making sure there's nothing lacking at all. In Jesus, you see a complete and utter total revelation of God. There's nothing that we can say, oh, but isn't the Father a bit different? No. All the fullness of the deity lives in him in bodily form. The Greek word is pleroma, which literally means the totality of divine powers. Sounds very formal, doesn't it? The totality of the divine powers lives in Jesus. The word dwell literally means should have its permanent abode. In other words, there's two things he's addressing here, which if you didn't acknowledge them, would be, you could argue, a heretical belief. Slightly softer way of putting it, you'd have a false understanding of who Jesus is. The first is, there's nothing missing of God in Jesus. These believers clearly thought there was something more that was required other than just an understanding of who Jesus was. And his point is, no, there's nothing more. That's it. That's all you need. Jesus. Secondly, this wasn't a temporary thing. There are some who believe that Jesus became God just for that moment on the cross, as if it's like a power zap of God died just for a moment, because it's so offensive, the idea of the incarnation. Some really struggle with that. And there are branches, if you look back at the history of the church, that have come up with all sorts of bizarre beliefs around it. It was a temporary thing. Jesus was God, but only for a temporary moment in time. But his point is, no, this is a permanence. The fullness of the Godhead dwells in Jesus, dwelling being a full-time, permanent state of being. I'm conscious of time, so I'll zap on to my final eighth point. And through him, to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. I wonder again, I mean, just think about this. Is this all things word, is universe? Did you realize that when Jesus was dying on the cross, he wasn't just reconciling you and me, he was reconciling the universe? It's a bizarre way of thinking, isn't it? And actually, if you look at this again, this passage, did you realize there are things in heaven that need reconciling? This is what it says. It says, whether things on earth or things in heaven. I'm not sure I understand how things in heaven need reconciling. It slightly blows my understanding, if I'm honest. But let's understand what he exactly is saying here. Reconcile to himself literally means to bring them all under one head. So in other words, what we're saying is, through him, he is bringing everything under his lordship. He is the head not only of the church, he is head of creation, he is head of heaven, he is head of everything. And through his blood, he's bringing everything back together again. So literally creating a way for heaven and earth to be reconciled. That's why in Revelation we have that picture of the new heaven and the new earth coming together as one, which is why I hate it when people talk about going to heaven. Going to heaven is going to the new earth, new heaven, new earth, together for all time. Not some sort of ethereal out there thing. Together. And to do this, Jesus had to be fully God and fully man. That's the only way you can have that kind of reconciliation. Otherwise, how could God, that distant, isolated God we talked about earlier on, possibly connect with man that separate? But if he was fully only man, how could he possibly bridge that chasm to the God that's separate and isolated? He has to be fully God and fully man. It's the only way. Which is why fundamentally all these other religions, you can, on that basis alone, you can confound them, frankly. There has to be a way of connecting man to God. And the only way is fully God, fully man. And that's what Jesus does to bridge that gap, to bring that true reconciliation. It's pretty awesome, isn't it? Just to finish, I want to just ask the question, why did Paul put all this together, this amazing, dense theology, quite early on in his letter to the church in Colossae? I want to suggest there are three things, and then we're going to look at how that those three things are relevant for us today. First one is, there is no Jesus plus. He is God's fullness. And they say, therefore, there is no room for anything else. All this stuff with you've got to do these rituals, you've got to do it in a particular way, there's a particular service pattern you need to follow, you've got to talk to angels, you've got to do something else. It just is fundamentally got rid of, because when you understand who Jesus truly is, that he is the only reconciler that can possibly do anything of any use between us and the deity, it's only Jesus. There isn't anything else. It's all him. So number two, therefore he is the absolute reconciler of God to the whole of creation. There's no room for any other mediator. Even angels, which is clearly a focus that they had in the Colossae church. Great. Great to have angels blessing people or whatever it is that they were focusing on, but that's not the focus. The focus is on Jesus as the one who connects us back to the living God. And the third thing is that the church is his body under his authority and power. Therefore, it's not for us to say how we want to be, what we want to do, to pick and choose our faith. We can think of those other passages talking about the body and the head, and you kind of the hand can't say to the eye, you're no use, and all that stuff. The body is designed to be the body. The head tells us what to do. So in other words, we need to know our place. So very, very much finally, just three questions to pose. And maybe this is something to take away and maybe to think about when you're in cells this week. First is, where do we add to Jesus? I mean, it's quite clear that this is a context in Colossae where they were adding to Jesus, but where do we do that? Because I suspect we do without even realizing it. It's interesting when we talked in that series of sacred pathways, just thinking about how easy it is to kind of develop our own ways of doing things, and so we create our own patterns and traditions and rituals or whatever you want to call them, and that's adding to Jesus. It's creating something more, and to an extent that can be helpful, but actually is it creating something that's just more than Jesus? Second one, where do we need to recognize and release the leadership, the management, the authority of Jesus as the reconciler to creation? If we view Jesus as not only the reconciler of us personally, but the reconciler of all creation, the whole universe, where do we need to be seeing that leadership, that authority being released? And how can we be a part of that? That's just thinking about prayerfully, where are we wanting to see that being released from our own experience? Jesus the reconciler. And thirdly, where do we think that, if we're honest, we're not living out a life that's in his likeness? The God that loves, that is kind, that is compassionate, that expresses emotion, that goes out of his way, that gives of himself time and time again. And so where do we need to be thinking about how we live out a life worthy of Jesus? That's it. I think we should worship, don't you? So if I could close in prayer, let me just pick up one of your songs. We won't do it with music, we'll just sing a cappella, if that's all right. And let's sing an easy one that we'll know the words to, All Hail King Jesus. All hail King Jesus.